Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the Oklahoma legislative session continues, there's been no shortage of bills that have attracted attention from the national media for less than favorable reasons, like bills banning hoodies or AP history or allowing businesses to discriminate against their gay customers or ending civil marriages in the state. What there hasn't been is a responsible discussion about the issue that most affects most Oklahomans. That's how to fill a roughly 10% shortfall in the state budget, $611 million in a funding gap for next year's budget. This shortfall, coming after a number of years of flat or diminishing state budgets, have stretched many agencies to an unsustainable path where many agencies are seeking budget increases next year to just maintain the level of service they've had. So what are the answers to our budget situation? The Oklahoma Policy Institute has offered 7 suggestions, 3 to deal with the immediate situation, such as tapping the rainy day fund, limiting the statutory increases for transportation, which will receive $56.7 million more next year, the careful use of reserves and revolving funds, which were used to balance the budget last year as well. Longer-term solutions include repealing the latest income tax cut, eliminating the state income tax deduction for itemizers, accepting federal funds to expand health coverage in the state, and reforming corporate reporting for taxes. My guest today is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, David Blatt, who joins us today on Studio Tulsa. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back on.
Well, you know, the Oklahoma legislature is in full swing, and we're hearing a lot of talk about ending AP history. We're talking about anti-gay bills in the legislature, conversion therapy. We're talking about all sorts of things in the legislature, but we're not talking about the big issue confronting state leaders this session, and that is the $611 million shortfall. Why are we not hearing a lot about this?
Well, to a certain extent, the problem is that the budget shortfall is so large that nobody quite knows how to get their head around it. But also, honestly, and it pains me a little to say this, given that Oklahoma Policy Institute focuses on budget and tax issues, but budget and tax issues are not the sexiest issues in the world. It's harder to get the attention of national media outlets when you put forward a proposal to change budgeting processes or to transfer money out of revolving funds than when you look to abolish AP or ban hoodies or some of the other things that have put Oklahoma in the national spotlight in recent weeks.
We've had no shortage of the national spotlight, but this is a looming issue. $611 million is how much of our total budget?
A little under 10%. So
that's 10%. That is huge.
It is extremely significant. So total state appropriations this past year were a little under $7.2 billion. So $611 million would be about 7 to 8%. What is particularly difficult about this shortfall is that Oklahoma's budget never fully recovered from the last economic downturn. When we experienced the recession of 2009-2010, there were budget shortfalls even larger than that, although in that case, you had the federal stimulus money. The feds kind of came in and helped bail out the states to some extent, but we were looking at $600, $800 million shortfalls. We muddled through, but across state government, we saw significant cuts. And while we saw some increases in recent years, we never really fully recovered. So when you look at public schools, the state support for public education through the state aid formula, the main money that goes to the support of schools, is almost $200 million below where it was 6 years ago. Our prisons are staffed at under 70%. Our Medicaid budget was cut last year by providers all saw rate cuts of 7 to 8%. So we never fully dug our way out of the hole. And now, through a combination of policy decisions and economic circumstances, we're facing another round of shortfalls and potential cutbacks.
So what do we attribute this shortfall to? The 611 of it, how much is it driven by falling oil prices?
Right.
How much of it has to do with policies that have been previously put into place?
It's really a combination. I would say that it's almost half and half. The $600 million, which is the difference between how much money has been certified as available for next year compared to how much was appropriated this year. That's a $611 million less.
Now, people are probably just shaking their head at that, just what you said. Explain how that works, because the money is certified in a longer length of time than the budgeting takes place.
Well, the way it's done is there is a board that meets twice a year in December and then again in February to certify estimates of how much revenue there's going to be for the next year. And those calculations are done by economists and taken to the tax commission and other state agencies. And basically this board of equalization, which is made up of a number of statewide officials, they come in and essentially rubber stamp these economic projections. Well, in December, when they first looked at next year, they were already estimating about a $300 million shortfall. And that was before we really started to see the impact of lower oil prices and low gas prices. That $300 million shortfall in December was almost entirely due to budget decisions made last year. That was using several hundred million dollars of one-time revenue from cash reserves, from funds that sit in agencies, $300 million from that, and also from a tax cut that is now going to go into effect next year. When you factored those things in, it was going to be a $300 million shortfall. When they came back in February with new economic projections, once they started hearing the news that Helmerich & Payne was laying off thousands of workers and Baker Hughes and other oil companies, not only does that have an effect on projections of oil and gas revenues, but really the income tax in particular. Between December and February, they lowered their projections for income tax revenues by $200 million. Hmm. So we were already looking at a $300 million shortfall before we really saw the extent of the impact of the slowdown in the oil and gas industry. Now that shortfall has doubled to about $600 million.
And the shortfall comes from the appropriations were done last session, right?
Right. So this year in the budget, as I said, it was about a little over $7 billion, about $7.2 billion. Most of that money was recurring tax revenue. But just to make this year's budget balance, they took some $400 million in one-time cash. Cash reserves and agency revolving fees.
So let's talk about revolving funds for a second, because we heard about that. Is revolving funds basically appropriated money that wasn't spent for one reason or another?
It's a little different. Revolving funds are associated with an agency, with the health department or the Department of Consumer Credit or the Department of Environmental Quality. One revolving fund in the health department is plumbers' licensing fees. The health department does licensing for plumbers. To get your plumber's license, you pay a fee. That money goes into the health department. It's intended to be used for licensing and regulatory responsibilities associated with that profession. There are nursing home regulatory fees. There are various used tire fees. Basically, revolving funds tend to be made up of fines and fees. They're not appropriated by the legislature, and they're not subject to the requirement that they be used in the year that they're gathered.
So what happens is you have
ongoing
fees pile up. It doesn't take that much money to actually do the regulatory nature of those fees. So money sort of accumulates.
Money accumulates. And that's even oversimplifying it some. So
okay,
if anybody is not already passed out listening to this over the complexity, you have some revolving funds that are made up from certain tax sources, some are from fines. But basically last year, the legislature went in and transferred over about $200 million from various agency revolving funds. In a couple of cases, they transferred over revolving funds that really were not theirs to take. So in two cases, the Attorney General was asked to review this and ruled that the legislature's action in taking money from a particular fund and using it for general appropriations was illegal. There was $9 million taken from a higher education scholarship trust fund. There was some money taken from a trauma care fund. The bigger point here is that if you go back a year to where we were last year, Oklahoma had one of the strongest economies in the nation. We had, I think, maybe the fourth lowest unemployment rate. Personal income was growing. Even last year, when the economy was doing well, we still were unable to pay our bills. We still were having to dip into and raid revolving funds. We still implemented cuts to most state agencies last year of 5.5%, which points to what we talk about as a structural budget deficit or fiscal gap, where in good years and in bad, the state is not generating enough tax revenue to pay for the cost of basic services, to pay for teachers and prison guards and health inspectors and healthcare costs for those in nursing homes and so on. We have serious long-term problems, which only get worse, of course, when you do hit an economic bump and you're dealing with oil at $40 a barrel.
Let's talk about where we are now. Again, we're not hearing a whole lot of talk from the legislature about what to do over the $611 million. I've heard talk of getting into the rainy day fund. I think there's a little over $500 million in the rainy day fund. I assume there's still more money in those revolving accounts, although they're less than there was. Our state constitution makes it virtually impossible to pass a tax increase of any sort. So where did he come up with 611 other than just cutting?
So what the leaders have said is that everything is on the table, which is a bit of an overstatement because, as you said, it's almost impossible to raise taxes. So if you're wondering whether they're going to restore the top income tax rate from its 5.25% back up to where it was a decade ago, six and a half, seven, mm-hmm. that's not going to be on the table given constitutional and political obstacles. But what they're trying to signal is that they recognize that they can't simply cut their way to a balanced budget. When you look at how much has been cut in recent years, when you look at how far down we are in support for schools, in our staffing ratios and correctional facilities, in the number of people without health insurance, there's really a limit to how much further you can go without inflicting serious, serious pain on the population. So they're signaling their openness to various things that would take effect on the revenue side. The rainy day fund is one option. Revolving funds are another option. We very much hope that they will go back and reconsider the tax cut that was decided last year, which would lower our top income tax rate from 5.25% to 5%. They said that the tax cut was only going to take effect if revenues were going to grow. The way they wrote the bill, it somehow happened that the tax cut trigger took effect, and yet we're still facing a $600 million shortfall and several hundred million dollars in projected less tax revenue. So when you're in a situation where you're facing huge cuts, where you're looking at no great options on the table, to have a tax cut to the top income tax rate, which has already been slashed from 7% down to 5.25%, a tax cut that would primarily benefit the most affluent households. The average Oklahoma household would get $29 from this tax cut. 40% would get nothing at all. The first thing they need to do is say we're going to cancel or suspend that tax cut at least until our budget situation improves.
Now, from a constitutional standpoint, can they do that before the income tax cut takes effect?
Well, you could get different opinions from what I've heard, and my understanding is that if the tax cut hasn't taken effect, if you're just suspending implementation of a tax cut that is scheduled to go into effect January 1st, 2016, they absolutely can do that. It's a simple statutory change with a simple legislative majority. And that really should be the first thing. Even listening to their own language of a year ago, they said, we want to be responsible. We only want the tax cut to go in if revenues are growing. Well, newsflash, revenues are not growing, and yet this tax cut is still barreling down. That's $50 million towards this year's shortfall, but then it becomes a $150 million tax cut next year. And if the top rate continues to fall, as the bill says, it's going to be almost a $250 million tax cut. How can we be doing that when teachers haven't had a raise in 7 years? How can we be cutting our income tax further when there are 7,000 families on a waiting list for services for those with developmental disabilities? We are not taking care of our basic needs in the state, and yet we're moving ahead with a tax cut that will provide almost no benefit for most Oklahoma families.
My guest today is David Blatt, the Executive Director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, okpolicy.org. The deadline for bills to pass out of their chamber of origin is this Thursday, yet the big story of this legislative session will be the leadership of the two houses and the governor's office getting together to figure out how to deal with this $611 million shortfall. That's the whole thing, is the rank and file have very little say in how the budget is appropriated. It's the leadership that pretty much determines this behind closed doors, and I assume, you know, they're subject to some debate, but it's unless there's a wholesale revolt within the legislature, there's not a whole lot of changes to what the leadership comes with as far as funding levels behind closed doors.
That's very true. That has been the practice for a long time. I was on Senate staff in the late 1990s, and the big decisions at that time were made by the Senate president and the House speaker and a representative, sometimes a representative from the governor's office. That varied
depending on the parties,
depending on partisan differences and so on. And then some smaller decisions were then made by chairs of the appropriations committees. Since that time, I would say that the process has become even less inclusive and participatory, and really the subcommittee chairs have become largely uninvolved. There is some look now at reforming the budget process. The governor is strongly pushing going to a biannual. You continue to have the budget every year, but you would only look at substantive legislation every other year, which would mean that in year one, you would have bills being introduced on a whole range of subjects along with the budget. But in year two, it would be a budget year only, except with a supermajority override. The idea is that in that second year, it would give the legislators much more time to really dig deep into the budget. In theory, that's a good idea. In practice, there's at least two questions that can be raised. First of all, are they really going to decentralize authority down to the rank and file? And it's not sure that they will. It still may be three guys in a room in the last 10 days of session making the big decisions.
Really, that sounds like a dream budgeting. You know, here's what your wishes and desires are, and then the next year is like, okay, here's reality.
Sure. And the other question is, do we want the people who are introducing the hoodie bill and conversion therapy and many other far-fetched ideas to actually have real authority over the budget? So it may be one of these situations of being careful of what you ask for. That idea has been, though, proposed by the governor. It actually, the first I heard of it in Oklahoma came from then Democratic Lieutenant Governor Jerry Askins, who ran on that platform back in 2010. So it does have some bipartisan support. It's not clear whether it will happen, but at least the intent is to give more people a chance to really dig in on the budget.
You've outlined in your Policy Institute a few ways in which we could maybe reduce the shortfall. One, you mentioned earlier, canceling the income tax cut, but you also talked about things like eliminating the deduction for state income taxes, taking another look at tax incentives, which that is one thing that seems to be happening this legislative session. It seems to happen every session, but when it comes to actually moving the needle changing a tax deduction or a tax credit, the wheels get kicked out before it actually becomes a bill or of some sort.
There are a couple things happening. One is that over the past year, the state has participated in a very in-depth study that has been led by the Pew Trust, a national foundation that came in and did an intensive review of our whole array of tax incentives. And they came up with a series of recommendations which are now have made their way into legislation being carried by the Senate President, Brian Bingaman, and House Speaker Jeff Hickman. And if those pass, which I think they will, what it would do would be set up a serious tax incentive evaluation process where on a regular basis, each tax incentive would be carefully scrutinized by outside experts to see what their effect is. Are they working? Are they creating jobs? What the cost is? And they would come up with recommendations. This is, I think, very valuable and laudatory, but it's not going to save us any money. It's not going to do away with any tax incentive in the short term. If the bill passes, it would take effect next year. By the time you went through the process, we'd be looking 2 or 3 years from now before this group of experts came back and said, you know, this tax incentive really has become a boondoggle. We should do away with it. This one is working but needs to be tweaked in that way. There are some things that can be done in the short term. And the one you alluded to briefly, we have certain provisions in our tax code that really don't make any sense. And one that really should be reexamined is the itemized deduction for state income taxes, which means that if you itemize on your federal tax return, which only about a quarter of Oklahomans actually do, tend to be upper income Oklahomans, if you itemize your federal returns, you get to deduct your state income tax. Oklahoma allows you to carry over your federal itemized deductions onto your state income tax. In most states, what they do is then back out that deduction for state income tax. Oklahoma allows you to keep it. So basically, it works as a double deduction. You are deducting your state income tax from your state income tax. It really is just a quirk of the tax code. It doesn't lead to any public policy purpose. It's not going to change behavior anyway. We should really just do away with it. And that would be close to $100 million, about 85% of which would be a slightly higher tax liability for those in the top 5% of income.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that can get through the legislature without having to have super majorities and votes of the people?
This would be simply doing away with a deduction. And my understanding of the way that the courts have looked at this is that if you simply close a loophole, if you don't raise a rate, then it is not subject to that supermajority requirement of State Question 640. So I think it can be done. Ideally, it would have a three-quarters majority. And you know, without question, there are tough choices being faced here. You know, anything that is seen as raising revenue is going to cause concern among some legislators. But when the alternative is deeper cuts in our classrooms, less staffing in our correctional facilities, serving fewer folks who need mental health services, cutting providers in the Medicaid program deeper, I mean, these are the real choices that they have to face. And across a whole bunch of areas of state government, we have tightened our belt and tightened our belt and tightened our belt to the point where we really are not able to get the level of services that Oklahomans depend on. So we hope that some sensible tax reform ideas, such as doing away with the itemized deduction for state income tax, do end up being discussed and being part of the final package.
Now, another item that your organization has talked about is limit the funding increase for transportation, because we have dedicated monies. Right. And this is also part of the overall budget story, is that we have provisions in place which automatically dedicate certain amounts to various things, transportation right. being one of them.
Right.
So transportation is going to see an increase.
The way that the statutes are written, and this over the last 10 years, transportation has been very effective in ensuring that whatever the budget situation looked like, they get additional money. Now, I drive on the roads, you drive on the roads, and we can all point to the real need to take care of our roads and bridges.
And I will say in defense, we had the head of the civil engineers, and you know, infrastructure is one of the worst things going on in our country, and that provision has changed our bridge outlet from
right.
being from one of the worst states with deficient bridges to one of the better states with the fewest deficient bridges.
Right. And it's a question of priorities here. Yeah. And at this point, we are, you know, in a crisis situation and triaging and which patients are going to get care and which ones are going to be later in the queue. Well, transportation has been guaranteed a $60 million increase year after year after year. So last year, when most agencies got flat funding or got cut 5%, transportation got a $60 million increase. This year, they're scheduled for another $60 million increase. That roads fund that was put in place to address some of these critical infrastructure needs, it's already at $415 million. We would argue that it probably makes sense this year to suspend that increase or to limit it so that, you know, transportation could be kept whole this year, not to lower the amount going to transportation, but not to give it that $60 million if, again, the alternative are deeper cuts to education, public safety, health, human services, and so on.
Approximately $60 million increase is almost 10% of the shortfall.
Right. Yeah. And I should say it's $57.9 million, but it's close enough.
Another thing you're talking about, and this could be another issue depending on what happens at the Supreme Court, but you're advocating that the state does accept federal funds to expand health coverage and accept expanded Medicaid. Now, what the governor's always said, that this was going to cost too much money in the long term and perhaps even in the short term, but I've seen new analysis which says based on what we're already spending on health care, we'd actually save money by expanding Medicaid.
The governor is simply mistaken in this, and she should know it because the report that was done a year and a half ago by the Levitt Group, which was commissioned by our Medicaid agency and by Governor Fallon herself, looked at this and said that over a 10-year period, if we accept federal funds to expand health insurance coverage, the net impact would be a savings of around $450 million to the state of Oklahoma. Well, how can that be? The federal government is committed to paying 100% of the cost of those who are newly covered until 2016. That will phase down to 90% going forward. So there will be a little state cost, but that will be more than fully offset by being able to take spending that we're already doing in the mental health department for corrections, for the Department of Health, for public health services, part of our existing Medicaid program, and being able to roll those costs over into the Medicaid expansion budget. So what we're covering, what we're already paying for with 100% state funds or 35% state funds would be covered entirely or 90% with federal funds. That would create real savings that, now that's not going to make our $600 million shortfall go away, but it would provide us at least some budgetary relief as well as being the right thing to do in providing coverage to 150,000 uninsured Oklahomans who tend to be those with low income and poor health status. They don't have health insurance because they're poor. They're poor because they don't have health insurance. It's a vicious cycle that they're in. They were supposed to be covered under the Affordable Care Act through Medicaid, but because of the court's ruling a couple years ago, that became each state's choice, and they've ended up in a coverage crater. It is the right thing to do for those families, for our businesses, for our healthcare system, our rural hospitals and community health providers like Morton Comprehensive Healthcare that are really, really struggling with the costs of the uninsured. It really is a win-win situation with some good budgetary implications.
All right. David Blatt, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Rich.
David Blatt is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. To learn more about their 7 priorities for Oklahoma in 2015, visit their website at okpolicy.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.